December 14th, 1981. St. John's, Newfoundland. 14-year-old Dana Bradley leaves her friend's residence to head back home, but never arrives, and eyewitnesses report seeing her hitchhiking and climbing into a vehicle driven by an unidentified man. 4 days later, Dana's body is found in a remote wooded area, and she has been killed by multiple blows to the skull with a blunt instrument. Over the next 4 decades, investigators explore a number of different leads, including a confession from a suspect that is later recanted, and an account from a witness who claims he was present when Dana's murder took place, but all attempts to identify the killer are unsuccessful. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be returning to our podcast home country of Canada to cover a cold case that has remained unsolved for over 40 years, the 1981 murder of Dana Bradley. A few months ago, The Trail Went Cold reached a milestone in which we managed to cover at least one cold case from all 50 American states, so I made it a goal to eventually do the same thing for every Canadian province and territory. We're getting ever so closer to achieving that milestone because this particular episode is going to explore our first mystery from Canada's most eastern province, Newfoundland and Labrador. It is also considered to be the province's most prominent unsolved cold case, and over the years, I have received numerous requests to cover it on the podcast. Dana Bradley was a 14-year-old girl who attempted to hitchhike back to her family's residence in an era when hitchhiking was so much more commonplace. But tragically, Dana was picked up by the wrong person, as she never arrived home, and her body was discovered in a wooded area 4 days later. Even though Dana was last seen climbing into a car driven by a man, all attempts to track down and identify the vehicle and the driver were unsuccessful. Over the past 4 decades, there have been a few moments when it appeared that the case was on the verge of being solved, as a suspect was briefly charged with Dana's murder after making a confession, but the case fell apart when he recanted, and no corroborating evidence could be found to support his story. There's been a lot of controversy involving an eyewitness who came forward and claimed to have repressed memories of having witnessed Dana's murder when he was a child. Even though this witness pointed the finger at a sex offender who had previously served time in prison, investigators cannot find the necessary evidence to support his story and do not find it to be credible. The authorities do have a male DNA profile for Dana's killer, but while they have yet to match the evidence to a suspect, the case definitely seems to be solvable, so we're going to provide some additional exposure on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early accessed episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murder of Dana Bradley. Our story begins in 1981 in St. John's, the capital city of the Canadian province of Newfoundland and Labrador. Our central figure is 14-year-old Dana Bradley, who lives with her mother and stepfather, Don and Jeff Levitz. The couple married when Dana was still a small child, and she is currently a 9th grade student at I.J. Sampson Junior High School. After finishing school on the afternoon of December the 14th, Dana went to visit a friend of hers at a residence at Curry Place. Since it was her mother's birthday, and the family were planning a celebration that night, Dana phoned them up shortly after 5 p.m. to let them know she was heading home. Dana said that she had bus fare and was likely planning to catch the next bus on Topsail Road, located just around the corner from her friend's place. But after Dana left, she never made it home, and her family eventually became concerned enough to contact the Provincial Police Service, the Royal Newfoundland Constabulary, in order to report her missing. When Dana's disappearance was publicized in the local newspapers, a pair of brothers named Harry and John Smeaton came forward to report having seen Dana at around 5:20 p.m. on the night she vanished. The Smeatons had been selling Christmas trees at a roadside stand located behind the bus stop on Topsail Road, and while they were sitting inside their truck together, they recalled seeing Dana show up at the bus stop and stick her thumb out to hitchhike. A car soon pulled up, which was being driven by an unidentified man, and since Dana couldn't get the handle on the front passenger side door to work, the Smeaton said that the driver had to open the door from the inside. After Dana climbed into the front seat, the vehicle drove off, but at the time, the Smeatons didn't think the incident was significant enough to catch the license number. However, they would describe the car as being a four-door sedan which was beige, tan, or faded yellow, and had noticeable rust marks on it. While they were unsure of the vehicle's make, they felt it may have been a mid-1970s model Dodge Dart or Plymouth Valiant. Dana would remain a missing person for the next 4 days, but at around 3 p.m. on December the 18th, a family was searching for a Christmas tree in a remote wooded area located alongside Maddox Cove Road, just south of St. John's. They wound up stumbling upon Dana's body, which was laid out on a hill in what the police would later describe as a quote-unquote burial fashion. She was fully clothed with her arms folded across her chest, and her school books were neatly tucked under her arm. The autopsy would reveal that Dana's exact cause of death was a fractured skull, which was the result of repeated blows to the head with a blunt instrument. Investigators would not publicly confirm or deny if Dana was sexually assaulted, though they believe she was murdered on the exact same day she disappeared. A couple would soon come forward to report that while driving on Max Cove Road at around 1 a.m. on the morning of December the 15th, they passed by a vehicle which matched the description of the car Dana had been seen climbing into several hours earlier. The vehicle was parked near the spot where Dana's body was found, with the passenger side door open, and the couple also reported seeing a man standing near the woods with no jacket on, even though it was a very cold night. He was reported as being a white male with dark hair, believed to be in his mid-20s, and on the basis of the descriptions provided by the couple and the Smeaton brothers, a composite sketch was created and circulated for him. The Royal Newfoundland Constabulary and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, aka the RCMP, soon formed a joint task force and launched what has since been described as the most expensive and exhaustive murder investigation in the history of Canada. In the weeks following Dana's murder, over 2,000 cars from the area would be examined by investigators, which matched the description of a mid-1970s model Dodge Dart or Plymouth Valiant, but they found no evidence that any of them had been used in the commission of Dana's murder. During this time period, Dana's family were tormented by a series of anonymous phone calls, which often took place at odd hours, and involved a man who kept initially asking to speak to Dana before he confessed to killing her. The calls were traced back to a 22-year-old resident named Bruce Gerard Connors, and while he wound up receiving a 9-month jail sentence for the harassment, he was not considered to be a suspect in the crime. Over the next several years, hundreds of people would be interviewed, and thousands of tips were investigated, but a promising development finally took place in January of 1986, when the RCMP received an anonymous note implicating a 35-year-old suspect named David Somerton in Dana's murder. Somerton had a prior criminal history, which included serving time in a New Brunswick prison for armed robbery, so he was taken in for questioning. Shortly thereafter, it was announced that Somerton had confessed to killing Dana, and he was subsequently charged with her murder. The RCMP would claim that Somerton provided details about the crime which were never released publicly and believed his confession was consistent with the known facts. While the Smeaton brothers cannot positively identify Somerton as the driver who let Dana into his car, they thought it could be him. Somerton confessed that he disposed of the vehicle at the Robin Hood Bay Landfill and Recycling Center and buried the murder weapon along Maddox Cove Road, near the area where Dana's body was discovered. So the RCMP launched some excavations to recover them. However, it wasn't long before Somerton recanted his confession, as he had a history of substance abuse issues and mental illness, and claimed that after being interrogated by the police for 18 consecutive hours, he was on the verge of a suicidal breakdown. Summerson said that he pretty much told the police what they wanted to hear because he felt it was the only way he would ever get to leave the interrogation room, and it turned out that no evidence could be found to corroborate his confession. The two excavations cost a combined total of nearly $1 million, but they failed to turn up the missing car or the murder weapon at the locations where Summerton said he left them. In the end, the murder charges against Summerton were stayed, but since his false confession had wasted police time and resources, he would be charged and convicted of public mischief and received a 2-year prison sentence. Once again, the investigation hit a brick wall, though the RCMP stated that they would still receive an average of 50 tips per year. In 2003, Ron Hines, a prominent folk singer slash songwriter from Newfoundland, released a song titled The Ghost of Dana Bradley, which would also be the title of an episode about the case, which was produced during this time period by the Canadian news magazine TV show W5. And that same year, author Darren McGrath also published a book titled Hitching a Ride, The Unsolved Murder of Dana Bradley. In March of 2014, a St. John's-based newspaper called The Telegram would publish a series of articles about the case, featuring interviews with a witness who claimed to have been present when Dana was murdered. In order to protect his identity, the witness went by the pseudonym Robert, but he said that he was only 6 years old at the time Dana was killed and had been in the backseat of the car which picked her up from the bus stop. Robert claimed that he had spent many years struggling with alcoholism, but after becoming sober in recent years, he believed that some repressed memories from his youth had popped back into his head. According to Robert, Dana's killer was a former neighbor and family friend who had also sexually abused him during his childhood. On December the 14th, 1981, Robert said that his parents were out for the evening, so he and his 4-year-old brother were being watched by this family friend. The friend decided to borrow their father's car, a 1972 Dodge Dart, in order to take the two boys to the McDonald's on Topsail Road. As they were leaving, Robert said that the man pulled over to pick up a teenage girl who was hitchhiking. This girl turned out to be Dana Bradley, and while Robert and his younger brother were in the back seat, the man started making advances toward Dana, who proceeded to fight him off and scratch his face before escaping the car. This prompted the man to stop and chase Dana down, and after he sexually assaulted her, he proceeded to commit murder by bludgeoning Dana with a tire iron from the car. After putting Dana's body in the trunk, he drove out to Max Cove Road and disposed of the murder weapon. He then attempted to dump Dana's body over an embankment, but changed his mind and decided to retrieve it before putting Dana back into the trunk. Afterward, he drove to the spot where Dana's body was ultimately found and tied some booster cables around her body to drag her away from the road. Robert claimed that he was the one who folded Dana's arms across her chest and tucked her school books under her arm because he felt so awful about what had been done to her. The neighbor then drove the two boys back home, but after Robert went to bed, he said that this man woke him up and forced him to accompany him back to the murder scene, as he had apparently left his jacket behind, as well as the booster cables which were still tied around Dana's body. The neighbor wanted Robert to function as a lookout in case anyone stopped by, but while they were there, Robert recalled seeing a car drive past them, which seemed to corroborate the story from the couple, who had reported seeing a vehicle parked at that location at around 1 a.m. that night. After the man drove back to his own house and washed the inside of his trunk, Robert said that he sexually assaulted him in the back seat before bringing him home. Robert believed that he managed to block this incident from his memory for the next 3 decades until he gave up drinking and these memories suddenly came back to him. In December of 2011, around the 30th anniversary of Dana's murder, Robert got in touch with retired RCMP Superintendent Jack Lavers, the former lead investigator, in order to share a story. Lavers proceeded to refer Robert to the RCMP, who would launch an investigation into Robert's account, which lasted 16 months. In the end, the RCMP ultimately dismissed Robert's story, as they believed that the details he provided did not align with the evidence and were inconsistent with many of the established facts. According to RCMP Sergeant Ken Osmond, the new lead investigator, Robert changed his story on multiple occasions and shared information which had been published in media accounts of the case, which turned out to be erroneous. For example, Robert described injuries to Dana which were not actually inflicted on her and did not recall some of the actual injuries she did receive. He also got details about Dana's clothing wrong and described her as having possessions which did not actually exist. Investigators interviewed members of Robert's family, including his younger brother, who denied Robert's claims that he had been present in the car that night when Dana was killed. As you recall, Robert said that the perpetrator had borrowed his father's 1972 Dodge Dart in order to commit the crime. When interviewed, Robert's father did confirm owning a vehicle like that in 1981, and even provided photographs of it, but the problem is that it had been a two-door sedan, and the Smeaton brothers had told police they saw Dana climbing into a four-door sedan. The Smeatons also did not report seeing two children in the back seat, though Robert tried to account for this by saying that he and his brother did not use their booster seats and may not have been visible through the windows. However, Robert's father confirmed that in the weeks following Dana's murder, the RCMP had visited his residence in order to perform a routine check of his vehicle, and they found nothing to suggest it had been used during the commission of a crime. While the neighbor Robert implicated had served time in prison during the 1990s for sexually abusing children, investigators could find no evidence to link him to Dana's murder. The RCMP sent Robert to a doctor who specialized in forensic psychiatry, who believed that he was suffering from false memory syndrome. However, a neuropsychiatrist who later examined Robert rejected this diagnosis because he believed Robert was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder and repressed memories. Whatever the case, Robert still believed that his memories of Dana's murder were genuine and claimed that the Dodge Dart had been buried on private property belonging to his family near the small town of Whitless Bay. Both the Dart and a four-door Plymouth Valiant Robert's father once used for parts had been buried there as landfill sometime during the 1980s, and Robert wanted the RCMP to perform an investigation and unearth the vehicles to search for potential forensic evidence. However, the RCMP declined to do so, believing that all the holes and inconsistencies in Robert's story ruled out the possibility that the car had any connection to the crime. This is what compelled Robert to come forward and publicly share his story with the Telegram in 2014, and he would eventually team up with a privately funded group of civilians who ran a Facebook page titled Justice for Dana Bradley. In May of 2016, with the assistance of three retired police officers, the group funded their own excavation and made their own attempt to use backhoes to unearth the two cars. Dana's mother and stepfather, Don and Jeff Levitz, publicly stated that even though they trusted the RCMP's conclusion that Robert's story was not credible, they still supported the excavation, if only because they hoped it might finally put some false rumors about the case to rest. Well, after being buried underground for 3 decades, the vehicles turned out to be heavily degraded and had been contaminated with sewage runoff and other chemicals. In the end, all the excavation managed to recover were some car parts, and no useful evidence was found. But around this same time period, the RCMP announced a major development. Since Dana's body had been left outside of the elements for 4 days during some miserable winter weather, very little physical evidence was recovered from the scene, making it difficult to obtain any DNA. However, after the RCMP sent the evidence they did have to a lab in the United States for more advanced testing, they were finally able to extract a male DNA profile which likely belonged to Dana's killer. This DNA was subsequently used to rule out a number of potential suspects, including the former neighbor whom Robert had accused of committing the murder. While this was going on, David Summerton did an interview in which he expressed his willingness to provide a sample of his own DNA for comparison, but because of his mistrust of the RCMP, it would have to be done under certain conditions with an attorney present. In 1999, Summerton had received an 18-month prison sentence for indecent sexual assault involving a teenage girl, and claimed that his DNA was taken from him, but the sample had been contaminated, and the results were inconclusive. In January of 2021, Summerton passed away at the age of 70, but it's unclear if he ever did provide a new DNA sample to investigators or was ruled out as a suspect. All we do know is that the DNA profile has never been matched to anyone, so after 4 decades, Dana Bradley's murder continues to remain unsolved. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Hi there, I would just like to take a few moments to give a shout-out to another podcast titled Wrongful Conviction. Hosted by celebrated criminal justice reform advocate and founding board member of the Innocence Project, Jason Flom, and by Pulitzer Prize-winning podcast host and producer, Maggie Freeling, Wrongful Conviction features intimate conversations with men and women who have spent years in prison for crimes they did not commit. Each episode peels back the layers to tell the stories of those who have found themselves caught in a legal system gone wrong. Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling airs each Monday, and Jason Flom's episodes air on Thursdays. Please search, find, and follow Wrongful Conviction wherever you listen to podcasts. So this is definitely one of the most famous unsolved cold cases in the history of Canada, and it has already been covered on a number of true crime podcasts, both Canadian and American, such as Dark Poutine and Trace Evidence. I definitely believe the RCMP has put their heart and soul in trying to solve this case, as the investigation has consistently remained active for 4 decades, but in spite of a couple of promising leads, the identity of Dana Bradley's killer has yet to be uncovered. Last month, I released an episode about another cold case from the Maritimes, and that's the unsolved murder of Byron Carr, which took place in Prince Edward Island in November of 1988. Much like this case, the authorities have a male DNA profile for Byron's killer, and while it has been used to rule out a number of potential suspects, it has yet to be matched to anyone. But the key difference is that the DNA evidence in Byron's murder has deteriorated so much that it can't be tested with any advanced forensic techniques such as genetic genealogy. This past December, the genealogy website GEDmatch, which has been used to conclusively solve a number of cold cases these past 4 years, extended an invitation for the RCMP to use their services to solve Dana's case, though it's unclear if the authorities have taken them up on their offer. But this definitely seems like a very solvable crime, which is just lacking that one big break which has allowed investigators to positively identify a suspect and make an arrest. In many cases involving missing and murdered children, the victim's parents are often very outspoken advocates who constantly make appearances in the media to spread awareness. But Dana's mother and stepfather, Don and Jeff Levitz, they've kept a fairly low profile. Don has always found it to be too painful to speak about her daughter's death, so Jeff is the one who has done most of the interviews, but even though the crime is still unsolved, they have always expressed their appreciation towards the RCMP's work on this case, and honestly believe they've done the best job they can. I'm going to go into more detail about this a bit later, but there has been some online drama involving allegations that the RCMP is orchestrating a cover-up in order to protect the killer, but Dana's family certainly does not feel that way. Indeed, I'm inclined to believe that the perpetrator has just gotten very lucky by managing to stay under the radar for 4 decades. Now, there has been speculation that Dana's murder might be connected to the unsolved disappearances of 3 other young women which took place in St. John's between 1978 and 1984. Like Dana's case, all 3 of these disappearances took place shortly before or after Christmas. Sometime after midnight on December the 29th, 1978, 17-year-old Sharon Drover finished her shift at the McDonald's on Kenmount Road and was planning to hitchhike home to her boarding house, but she was never heard from again. Many years later, a pair of brothers came forward who claimed they had picked up a young female hitchhiker matching Sharon's description that night and dropped her off near her boarding house. They recalled seeing the young woman stop and talk with a man before she ran away, but this was the last anyone ever saw of her. On December the 11th, 1982, nearly 1 full year after Dana was murdered, Henrietta Millick, a 25-year-old Indigenous mother of 2, went to the Key Club on Water Street and was seen being harassed by 2 men. Since some of Henrietta's personal belongings, including her keys and purse, were left behind at the club, it was suspected that these 2 men may have forced her to leave against her will. But several years later, an eyewitness would come forward who believed he had picked up Henrietta hitchhiking that night and dropped her off somewhere on the Trans-Canada Highway. Our third unsolved disappearance took place on the evening of November the 12th, 1984, when 20-year-old Pamela Asprey hitchhiked from her boarding house to Martin's Lounge on Water Street and stayed for a couple of hours before she left. Pamela gave her wallet to a friend and said she would return to retrieve it in 20 minutes, but she never did. Pamela worked in the sex trade and had told people that a man was trying to pick her up, and at around 9 p.m., she was last seen climbing into a dark blue car with an unidentified male driver near the Newfoundland National Memorial. So could any of these women fall in prey to the same person who murdered Dana? Was there a serial killer operating in St. John's during this time period? Well, much like Dana, all three of these missing women were seen hitchhiking on the nights they went missing, and while it does seem likely that Sharon Drover and Pamela Asprey became victims of foul play, opinions are divided about what happened to Henrietta Millick, as it's possible that she may have become lost and disoriented while intoxicated and died of exposure in the cold winter weather. But in all these cases, there's just so little evidence to work with that we can't say with any certainty that there's a connection. However, since all three of these victims are still missing, I thought they were worth mentioning on this episode. Of course, the fact that Dana was hitchhiking on the night she went missing might raise some eyebrows today, but even though I'm sure this sounds like a cliched expression, it was just a much different time. This is not the only cold case I've covered in which a victim was harmed while they were hitchhiking, because in the 1970s and early 1980s, it was just a routine form of transportation that people without their own vehicles used to get around in their everyday lives. In fact, it's because of stories like Dana Bradley's that the world is now aware about how dangerous the practice can be. Granted, Dana was only 14 years old at the time, which seems really young to be hitchhiking, but it sounds like she had originally been planning to walk to a nearby bus stop to take the bus home after she left her friend's residence. It's unclear if Dana wound up missing her scheduled bus, but perhaps that's why she decided to stick her thumb out and hitchhike and just had the misfortune of being picked up by the wrong person. For all we know, Dana was not specifically targeted and may have been a completely random victim who was in the wrong place at the wrong time. The only reason we know that Dana was picked up hitchhiking was because of the eyewitness account from the Smeaton brothers, who said they saw Dana climbing into a vehicle being driven by an unidentified man at 5:20 p.m. Their story seems to be corroborated by the couple, who saw a similar-looking vehicle and a man on Maddox Cove Road several hours later at 1 a.m., parked near the spot where Dana's body was eventually found. Based on these sightings, it was believed that the vehicle was a mid-1970s model Dodge Dart or Plymouth Valiant, though none of the witnesses could say for certain. Police were able to put together a composite sketch for the man, but if you look it up online, the sketch is pretty generic, and the suspect just looks like your standard 20-something white male with nothing particularly distinctive about him. Whatever the case, investigators went out of their way to check thousands of vehicles matching the description and came up empty, even though the Smeaton brothers provided a very distinct detail, a passenger side door handle which did not work, which is why the driver had to open the door from the front seat to let Dana inside. Even though St. John's is the capital city of Newfoundland, it is not exactly what you'd call a huge metropolis, as it had a population of just under 84,000 people at that time, while the province itself had a population of around 575,000. There could have only been so many registered Dodge Darts, Plymouth Valiants, or other similar-looking vehicles in the area, so you have to wonder if the perpetrator either destroyed the car or managed to leave undetected. However, it's worth noting that St. John's is technically located on an island, so the only way to travel to and from the mainland in a vehicle would be by hitching a ride on a ferry. And of course, it's also possible that the witnesses were mistaken about the make and model of the car and led the investigation in the wrong direction. Now, investigators have never publicly confirmed if Dana was sexually assaulted, but she was found fully clothed, and it has been confirmed that semen was not found at the scene. When this case was featured on an episode of W5 in 2003, it featured an interview with the lead investigator at that time, Constable Chris McNaughton, who held up a baggie containing 10 strands of hair and said that this was the only physical evidence they could recover from the scene after Dana's body was left out in the elements for 4 days. McNaughton even stated that they couldn't be 100% certain that the hairs belonged to the killer, so it's unclear if this is the same evidence which was sent to the American Laboratory in 2016 to create a male DNA profile. Whatever the case, the RCMP does seem pretty certain that it is the perpetrator's DNA. Now, Dana's body was described as being found in a quote-unquote burial fashion, with her arms folded across her chest and her school books tucked neatly under her arm, and it's been theorized that the killer may have done this out of remorse. Indeed, it's certainly possible that he did not initially plan on murdering Dana when he picked her up, but then decided to make advances on her, and when she rejected him, he flew off the handle and killed her. We do know that she was bludgeoned to death with a blunt instrument, but since the murder weapon has never been found, we still have no idea what this instrument was. If the killer did feel genuine remorse about what they did, then perhaps they never went on to commit any more crimes and have managed to stay off the police's radar as a law-abiding citizen these past 40 years. The two people who have been most thoroughly examined as potential suspects are David Somerton and the family friend of the witness known only as Robert. But before we talk more about them, I want to bring up the name of a notorious individual who is often mentioned in online discussions about this case, even though there is nothing connecting him to the crime. The individual in question is Shannon Murren, who was originally born in Newfoundland, but attained notoriety when he was charged with the murder of 8-year-old Mindy Tran, which took place in Kelowna, British Columbia, in August of 1994. Murren was a neighbor of the Tran family at that time, but I'm not going to delve too deeply into this case right now, because I would need an entire podcast episode to do it justice. Long story short, Murren eventually wound up being found not guilty of the murder after a 7-month trial. He wound up returning to his home province of Newfoundland with one of the female jurors, who had fallen in love with him during the trial, which should give you a pretty good idea of what a massive train wreck this whole case is. Even though Murren has never officially been convicted of any murders, online sleuths have attempted to link him to a number of unsolved Canadian crimes, including the death of Dana Bradley. Even though Murren was living in British Columbia during the 1980s, it has been reported that he would return home to Newfoundland every Christmas. So while it's certainly possible that Murren was in St. John's in December of 1981 when Dana was murdered, we really don't know for certain, and there's no evidence to implicate him. So now we'll move on to the individual who was charged with Dana's murder at one point, and that's David Somerton. Now, we know that Somerton is definitely not a saint, as he had a criminal history, which included going to prison in 1999 for indecent sexual assault with a teenage girl. Somerton agreed to be interviewed on the aforementioned W5 episode, and while he maintained his innocence in Dana's case, he made a couple of disturbing statements, including that he once came close to killing his own children in order to prevent child welfare agents from taking them away from him. But in spite of whatever issues Somerton might have had, alarm bells immediately went off once I heard he was charged with Dana's murder based solely on a confession and no other corroborating evidence could be found to link him to the crime. It also kind of rubs me the wrong way that Somerton's confession caused him to receive a 2-year prison sentence for criminal mischief. I mean, it would be one thing if Somerton had willingly come forward and orchestrated a hoax to interfere with the investigation, but from what I can tell, the only reason he even appeared on the RCMP's radar was because they received an anonymous note which implicated him, and I've never seen any further details about where this note came from. By his own admission, Somerton only told investigators what they wanted to hear because he was interrogated for 18 consecutive hours in the same room, so do we really need to put someone behind bars for falsely confessing under those circumstances? It almost seems like the RCMP did that out of spite because they spent so much time and resources trying to find additional evidence to make the murder charge stick, but could not do so. Obviously, if DNA profiling had not been in its infancy back in 1986, they would have been able to implicate or rule out Somerton immediately, and there is some question about whether a comparison has been made to the new DNA profile which is available. Somerton did publicly state that he was willing to submit a sample of his own DNA under certain conditions, but I've never seen the RCMP publicly respond to this. While they have confirmed using his DNA profile to rule out a number of potential suspects, they've never specifically mentioned Somerton. Well, Somerton passed away a year and a half ago, so if a DNA match was made, I'm sure the authorities would not have hesitated to confirm this, which is why I'm inclined to believe he was not the killer. So now we have to move on to the saga involving the man known only as Robert, who claimed that he witnessed Dana's murder when he was only 6 years old and accused a former neighbor and family friend of being responsible. Even though the RCMP spent 16 months investigating Robert's claims and said that this story did not align with the actual evidence, there has still been some online drama surrounding this aspect of the story and conspiracy theories about the RCMP protecting the killer. If you search hard enough on social media, you'll be able to uncover Robert's real name, as well as the name of the accused killer. But even though this family friend did actually serve time in prison for sexually abusing children, I'm not going to repeat their names on this podcast, because I fear that will only complicate the issue. Even though Robert did struggle with alcoholism for several years, he was apparently in a good place when he became sober and decided to come forward to share the story, as he was a husband, father, and had a successful business career. I wouldn't say that Robert was intentionally orchestrating a hoax, as I believe there's a good chance that his claims about suffering childhood sexual abuse at the hands of this family friend are true, and this is his way of dealing with the trauma. Robert has always received support from the group who runs the Justice for Dana Bradley Facebook page, as they believe the RCMP prematurely dismissed the family friend as a suspect. Indeed, if you scroll through that page, you'll find some older posts from several years ago expressing outrage over the fact that this man was given a job as a school bus driver, even though he spent time in prison for sexually abusing children. I mean, that is a potentially serious issue worth addressing, but you get the sense that Robert's personal history with this guy might be distracting from the real goal of getting justice for Dana Bradley. This is what led to the group funding their own excavation to dig up the vehicle which was supposedly used in Dana's murder. The Facebook page was started by a man named Terry Hines, and in many cold cases, you might expect the victim's family to be on this group's side rather than the police. But Dana's mother and stepfather seemed to feel the exact opposite, as Jeff Levitz once addressed the situation with this statement, quote, "It is lovely to see how many people are still interested in Dana's case, and I would never want to deter anyone from contacting the police with information that might help in solving her murder. However, if it's on the internet, it must be true, is not the case. One should take everything they read on these sites with a pound of salt. I feel the site is no longer about Dana, but rather about Terry Hines advocating for Robert. I can't stress enough our desire to have Terry Hines and his co-administrator stop using Dana's name in order to present biased information on a Facebook site which is supposed to be in her honor. In our opinion, this site is not about Dana, but rather about Robert and his crusade against the RCMP for not validating his accusations," end quote. That's a pretty powerful statement from Jeff, and once you break down Robert's story, it really doesn't hold up under tight scrutiny, and you can understand why the RCMP dismissed it. Under normal circumstances, I might have held the viewpoint that the police should have just gone through with the excavation in order to be sure, but they obviously felt that Robert's story was so full of holes that there's no way Dana's body was ever inside the trunk of that car. In a sense, it's almost reminiscent of the infamous theory from the Springfield 3 case about the three missing victims being buried underneath the parking garage of a local hospital. Even though some people believe the parking garage should be excavated just to quell the rumors, the authorities have always maintained that it's pretty much outright impossible for the victims to be buried there, so why waste time and resources on such a costly operation? Well, sure enough, when the group did their own privately funded excavation for the car back in 2016, they turned up nothing. But even if they did manage to find some evidence, there likely would have been a lot of chain of custody and admissibility issues, since this was a civilian operation, not a police operation. I've seen a number of cold cases where I believed investigators were doing a piss-poor job at ignoring crucial leads which could pave the way to the case being solved, but during interviews, I did feel that RCMP Sergeant Ken Osmond did a very thorough job at outlining specific issues with Robert's story and why they did not feel it was credible. I mean, I can understand Robert not providing a completely accurate account of events since he was only 6 years old at the time, but he apparently changed his story multiple times, and there were too many discrepancies which could not be ignored. In fact, according to Sergeant Osmond, the more specific details Robert provided, the less believable his story became, because how could someone retain such vivid memories from when they were six? I already outlined some of these issues earlier on in this episode, but Osmond believed that all the information Robert shared could have been obtained from news articles. Robert apparently took inaccurate details which had been published in the media and shared them as fact, and he was unable to provide any exclusive details which were not already in the public domain to prove he had inside knowledge of the crime. Even though Robert's 4-year-old brother was supposedly present when all these events took place, he had no recollection of them at all. Robert's parents also told investigators that they could not ever recall their neighbor borrowing their car and said that it would have been very unusual for him to take their two boys to McDonald's on his own. And why would he decide to pick up a 14-year-old girl and make advances on her when he had two children in the back seat? If the murder was not pre-planned, the neighbor would have needed to take a bunch of additional time to cover up the crime and dispose of Dana's body while Robert and his brother were with him. It's odd that this unscheduled absence wouldn't have been noticed by the boy's family, or that this traumatic experience didn't cause them to exhibit any strange behavior which was noticed by their parents. You almost get the sense that Robert threw certain details into the story for the purpose of corroborating the known facts. For instance, even though Dana was seen climbing into the car on Topsail Road at 5:20 p.m., there was the eyewitness sighting of the car and a man at the location her body was found at 1 a.m. So to account for this lengthy gap of time, Robert concocts a story about the family friend waking him up in the middle of the night and taking him back to the scene to retrieve some items he had left behind. Now, I'm not saying that Robert intentionally fabricated a hoax, as he may genuinely believe that all these events happened and has memories which feel real to him. But the fact of the matter is that the RCMP have confirmed that they've used DNA testing to rule out the family friend as a suspect. So all this discussion about the believability of Robert's story might be completely irrelevant. Of course, if you visit the Justice for Dana Bradley Facebook page, the impression they seem to have is that the DNA results were flawed, and the RCMP are going out of their way not to charge this man with Dana's murder. But what possible motive would they have to protect him? He has already served time in prison for sexually abusing children. It does seem like Robert suffered from serious trauma at some point in his life, and I truly do hope he finds peace and lives the best life possible. But I'm afraid that this whole saga may have muddied up the investigation, and that even if this former family friend did some terrible things to Robert, he was not responsible for what happened to Dana. But of course, that only begs the question, who really did kill her? Well, I brought up this possibility earlier, but I am inclined to think that the perpetrator is someone whom we've never even heard about. Even though they've conducted such an extensive investigation, it's possible that the RCMP have never interviewed or investigated the real killer, and even if they did, this person somehow managed not to arouse any suspicion. If Dana's death was unplanned, then it's possible that the perpetrator somehow managed to go on living a normal life and never committed any additional crimes. Much like the Byron Carr case, the authorities have the perpetrator's DNA and some compelling clues to their identity, but they just seem to be lacking that one final piece of the puzzle. Now, we know that GEDmatch has reached out to the RCMP and offered their services in hopes of potentially linking the male DNA profile to a suspect, and I suppose only time will tell if this occurs. While the RCMP have always been tight-lipped about certain aspects of this investigation, they have said that they do not consider it to be a cold case, as they are always actively working on it and pursuing new leads. If the eyewitness description of the unidentified male seen with Dana is accurate, then he would have been in his 20s at that time, meaning that he would be in his 60s today. There is a good chance he's still alive, and, well, one of the most satisfying things of the past 4 years is witnessing elderly men get arrested for a crime they committed decades earlier after they mistakenly assumed they had gotten away with it. That could certainly happen in this case, and I would love to see it come to fruition. So if you happen to have any information about the murder of Dana Bradley, please contact the Newfoundland and Labrador Divisional Headquarters of the RCMP at 709-772-5400. That's 709-772-5400. Or if you prefer to remain anonymous, you can call the Crime Stoppers tip line at 1-800-222-8477. That's 1-800-222-8477. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, I released a bonus episode about an infamous case from Unsolved Mysteries, the disappearance of Anne Sigmund, who became a wanted fugitive for the murder of her estranged husband, Charlie Sigmund, and she has not been seen in 35 years. In addition, I've dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, cover yet another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1987 murder of Don Smith. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Kenneth, Trista, and Madeline. Thank you all so much for your support. In addition, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing at the True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place at the Weston Park Central Hotel in Dallas, Texas, from August the 27th to the 28th. Myself and many other prominent true crime podcasts will be in attendance, and there will be a bunch of panel sessions, discussions, and live episodes. So in order to purchase tickets, please visit the website truecrimepodcastfestival.com. That's truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourselves a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶